This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a visit with Kim Conoco, the executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, as we are coming up on Arts and Humanities Month. A look at the fun arts and humanities activities coming up around the state, including some great opportunities for funding your arts project. We are going to start today with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us periodically for Philosophical Currents, a philosophical look at some stories in the news. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here as always.
So I wanted to talk about socialism today as we are coming out of this pandemic, and I'm using those words a bit loosely here. Some people are calling upon this time as a golden opportunity to look at the way that we do things, saying normal is just what we're used to. It's not right or wrong. So this idea of should school be in person? Should it be online? Should it be hybrid? And a lot of people have been talking about how we deal with access to healthcare and insurance. And a word that gets thrown around a lot in this conversation without very much understanding of what it means is socialism. And I want to keep the conversation somewhat specific to healthcare, but we should probably start with a pretty broad definition of what does socialism even mean?
Socialism is a funny word because the meaning that people use is kind of different than what it actually means. And also the history of socialism as an enemy of the United States is in flux, right? So for a very long time under the Cold War, the socialists were the Soviet Union, and that's who we were afraid of. And so if you weren't a socialist, if you didn't want to be a socialist, you didn't want to be, you know, the enemy. Now the socialists are the Swedes, right? And so all of a sudden, instead of the Soviet Union being our enemy, Sweden is the enemy. And that's a very, very different kind of enemy, and it's a very, very different meaning of the word. So originally, socialism was just an economic philosophy. It was the idea that the means of production were owned by the government. So the government would socialize the factories or the agriculture. And so the idea is that the government would swoop in and take control over the way that we produce goods. And from a centralized location, they would decide how much to produce, who to how much to pay, who to hire. And that has all sorts of economic consequences, some good, some bad. What socialism has ended up becoming, however, is just a code word for either a government that is too big or government benefits that some people think are unjustified. So already the term has shifted a lot in just 100 years.
When you say government too big, is this in the context of government has too much control or government is too expensive?
Largely the first, but the second is a component of it. So when we say government is too big, we're talking about economic influence, but you can't have economic influence without political power. And you can't have political power without, in some sense, affecting other people's political power. So when Ronald Reagan, for example, talked about government being too big, he meant largely economics and giveaways, but he also meant government getting involved in people's lives. And that's where you hear socialism now. So government is socialist, some people think, if they want to put some limits on gun ownership. A government is socialist if they want to make regulations about certain kinds of free speech. Now, again, that's not really socialism, but that's what people mean. And so that leads to the justification for why this is bad, if you think it's bad. And those range from I shouldn't be obligated to give other people money to government is too expensive. And so that's where the two sides tie in.
Well, it's interesting, Jack, that you talk about the evolution of our understanding of the word socialist and socialism, and talking about how that used to be the Soviet Union, and that was an enemy during the Cold War. I have always thought of, and please correct me, as the Soviet Union as communist, not socialist.
So USSR stands for United Soviet Socialist Republic. And it was called socialist because in Marxist theory, there's a period of socialism and a period of transition before you reach communism. Mm. Technically, under Marx, communism is the abolition of all private property. That gets very complicated, and that's a whole other conversation, which I'm happy to have. Socialism is the time of a strong government that is in the process of moving the economy to a centralized economy and ushering the people into that period, which often involves cultural changes, re-education, and a whole shift of power. So technically, okay, we've never really had a communist society in the world. Now, that's technically, right? That's like, mm-hmm, that's the lawyer's answer, right? You know, technically, we've never really had a communist power in the world. But by colloquial terms, the Soviet Union and China, for example, are communist countries. But then again, the term evolves over time.
So I wonder then, for people who take issue with this term socialism, is it really because it's considered a slippery slope, this transition into straight communism, into I don't own anything no matter how hard I work?
I don't think so. I think socialism has become a generic term in the United States for liberal policies that conservatives don't like, or left-wing policies that people on the right don't like. You know, the left has a tendency to call right-wingers fascists. And this too is problematic because it doesn't really refer to the word, to the true meaning of the word. And so when liberals call conservatives fascists because they're angry or they're being hyperbolic, conservatives will call liberals socialists for that same reason. And what they end up meaning is some forms of, you're stepping on my freedom and you're using the government to step on my freedom. Now, whether that's true or not is a whole other conversation again. But that's what the word socialism means in the United States. So when we want to talk about socialism in the United States and we want to talk about healthcare, the question we want to ask is giving healthcare to everybody stepping on other people's freedoms? Is paying for universal healthcare taking the money out of the pockets of people who are obligated to pay for strangers? That's the conversation that people are having now.
And so how do we address that question?
Well, this is where, interestingly enough, the libertarian shadow influences socialism. Now, two philosophies can't really be more further apart than libertarian and socialism, right? Libertarianism holds to a radical individualistic notion of freedom, and socialism is a collectivist philosophy. Libertarians have convinced folks that all taxation is theft, that every kind of government contribution that isn't voluntary is a violation of property rights. And so in order to have a socialist society, you have to increase taxes. In order to have a socialist society, you have to fund the government. You have to fund healthcare. And you have to get that from several different places, but the main place is taxation. So if the socialists want to increase taxes, the libertarians are going to come in and say, by increasing taxes, you're increasing theft. You're stealing money that I earned myself. Recall two elections ago when the Republican slogan was, I built this, right? When they were talking about small businesses and they were saying, I built this, I bought this. That was actually a form of this debate, because what the Democrats were saying was, you know, small businesses exist with assistance from the government, with regulations, with tax, with tax incentives. You know, someone has to build the roads and put in the streetlights that get to the small businesses. And the Republicans were saying, none of that matters. I built the business through my own, the work of my own two hands. And so therefore, I am the only one who gets credit. That is a variation on this libertarian versus socialism debate. And basically it asks the question, what responsibility do you have to contribute to the well-being of the community? And that's where the conflict comes in.
That's an incredibly difficult line to draw. And I think that this phrase, draw a line in the sand, is almost invented for this scenario because, yeah, starting your own business is hard and it takes everything that you have. And it's, in a lot of ways, easier to just show up at work and get paid every 2 weeks and not have to deal with all of these things. But of course, I didn't invent the internet and I couldn't get to a certain job site without a road. So drawing this line in the sand of, is it possible to have something like what I'll call socialist infrastructure, but still the capitalist economy? You have the roads that are paid for by the government via your taxes, but then you get to keep more of what you earned.
Well, let me answer that and then let me backtrack.
Okay.
So the answer is, yes, it is. And ironically, given the way I started the discussion, it's called Sweden, right? So Sweden is a lot more capitalist than people give it credit for. We'll get to that in a second. This idea of infrastructure and this idea of working hard to start a small business, those things are both very, very important. Last weekend, I did a bike race, a gravel race out in Lawton, North Dakota. It was very, very cool. The cyclists and I raced through the farmland on these gravel roads and on these dirt roads. And it was horrendously difficult. It was 30-mile-an-hour winds, and I thought it was going to take me 5 hours and 15 minutes, and it took me 6 hours and 45 minutes, right? Two things were happening simultaneously. First, I was using roads that someone had built beforehand, and I was in a race that someone had organized and planned and did all of those things. And at the same time, I was working incredibly hard. It was the hardest bike ride probably of my entire life. I burned 4,100 calories.
You know?
It was insane. And I had, at one point, I was on the side of the road for 10 minutes sitting having an existential crisis because I didn't know I could finish, right? Mm. Both of those things can be true at the same time. I can be using an infrastructure that someone else created and I could still be working incredibly focused and dedicated with my own energy and recognize that in the end, it is I who have to get over the finish line. And so the problem with the debate that the Republicans and Democrats had in that election that I mentioned earlier was that it suggested that the ideas were mutually exclusive, that either you have the infrastructure or you have individual hard work, when actually everything is the same, right? Everything takes both. So now let's go to Sweden again. Now, Sweden certainly has higher taxes than the United States, but Sweden also has 100% universal health care that everyone pretty much doesn't pay a cent for. They've got very long vacations. They've got safe streets. They've got incredible infrastructure in a whole host of other ways. But Sweden is also capitalist in the sense that you go to the supermarket and there are 30 different kinds of cereal to choose from. You can choose your cell phone provider. You get to choose your own profession. No one is telling you you have to do this or you have to do that. There is upward mobility in the society, so you can be in the lower income and not be – and then maybe your kids will be in the higher income. The question where Sweden and America disagree fundamentally and that leads to all of the other discussions is how far should the government let its citizens fall? How much are the citizens permitted to lose? In the United States, I could be walking down the street and I could trip and fall through no fault of my own, lose my leg, and then lose my then go bankrupt from the hospital bills and lose my job. Right? I mean, a lot would have to happen, but it could happen. And the programs to help me then are minimalist and often inadequate. In Sweden, that won't happen. In Sweden, you don't go bankrupt for the medical bills. And in Sweden, there's all sorts of protections to help people keep their jobs. The question that socialists have ultimately asked over and over again is there a point where it is unjust and immoral to let people fall below? Americans think not, or Americans think that point is really, really, really low, and that point is different depending on where you live, on who you are, on who your governor is, on who your legislature is. It varies radically. Sweden says no. There's this thing called human dignity. There's these things called necessities of life, and the government's job is to make sure that no matter what happens, whether it's your own mistake or someone else's or just an accident of life, no matter what happens, you are protected from going below that level. And the debate about socialism, just like the debate about healthcare specifically, is really about that. Is there a bottom level that we are morally obligated to say, we don't care what happened and we don't care whose fault it was, we will not allow you to sink below that level? That's where the controversy rests.
To put a finer point on that, could a person ask the question a little differently of maybe we can agree that the U.S. and Sweden, neither one wants this person to fall to this level of abject poverty because of something that didn't happen or that they didn't cause, for example. But more so the question is who pays for it and why. Maybe in Sweden the idea is, okay, the government can provide for its citizens because that's just part of what the government should do. But maybe in the U.S. or other places, it's not really about it's the government's job to make sure they don't fall that low. It's an individual's job to help collectively with their own wealth, or maybe even something like, isn't that the role of the church?
So there is a debate as to whether it's a private responsibility to provide charity, right?
Yeah.
And in the United States, right, that is part of what's going on. There's a sense that this is more private than public responsibility. But look, you now, I am sure, like me, have been to a dozen of these church fundraisers where someone has cancer and they have these medical bills and friends and community members come and bid on items or buy pieces of pie and they raise money. The best of those things will raise $10,000, right? I mean, you know, probably they raise $2,000 or $4,000, or in a smaller town, they'll raise $750, right? That's 10 minutes in a hospital, right? I mean, so the idea that the private sector can replace the government is nonsense. And the fact that private insurance can replace the government is a more compelling response. But as we know, private insurance companies are constantly looking for reasons and ways not to pay or to have lower deductibles and higher things like that. Now, philosophically, at the core of this is an idea that has its origins in the 17th and 18th century, and that is that there are these two groups of poor, the deserving poor and the undeserving poor.
Right.
The deserving poor are those who are working hard to get out of poverty, and they deserve assistance. The undeserving poor are those who are not working or who are unemployed because they're alcoholics or unemployed because, I don't know, God disfavored them, right? There's a thousand different reasons. And they, since they're undeserving, don't get financial assistance from the community. They don't get financial assistance from the government. A socialist perspective rejects that idea, rejects the idea that desert has anything to do with poor. Someone doesn't deserve to get cancer. Someone doesn't deserve to get hit by a drunk driver. That term doesn't apply from a socialist perspective. And so when you look at it at its moral core, you have to ask yourself, are you willing to distinguish between those who need and deserve help and those who need who don't deserve help? I find that distinction a little problematic, in part because people are going to disagree radically about what moral system you use for dessert, right? There are plenty of people in this country who think the moment you have an abortion, you don't deserve any help at all. You're a murderer, period. But 80% of the country think, no, that there's some room for abortion. So who do you listen to, the 20% or the 80%? Well, if it's a private discussion, then it depends on who your neighbor is. It depends on who your religious organization is. If it's a public discussion, then the majority has more power. It's really important to remember that when we talk about the government, we are talking about people. We're talking about representation. We're talking about voters. We're talking about lobbyists. And even in a socialist country like Sweden, it's a democracy. It's a representative democracy. There is no Western European socialist country that is not a democracy as well, and that doesn't have, frankly, better run elections than we have had the last couple times. So this is another one of the sort of philosophical nuances, that socialism is an economic philosophy. It's not a political philosophy. Mm. And so you can have a fascist socialism like the Nazi Party. Nazi stands for National Socialists, right? That's what the word comes from, Nationalsozialismus. That's where the word Nazi comes from. You can have a fascist socialist. You can have a democratic socialist. You can have something that is maybe a little stronger state, but not quite a democracy, you know, and anywhere on the spectrum. So socialism can match with a whole bunch of different things because it's ultimately an economic philosophy. And there is a small group that has weaved in and out of popularity for the last 50 years called the Democratic Socialists of America. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, they endorse Bernie Sanders, for example, right? So you have to be aware of the limitations of the term. Again, as Americans tend to use socialism, they mean it more as a political philosophy rather than an economic philosophy.
Well, and I wonder how much of it just comes down to this national identity that Americans have of rugged individualism versus we got here, you know, based on other things.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that that's a really, really astute comment, that one of the centerpieces of the American culture is this idea that we got to the West on our own, that we built these cities on our own. Mm-hmm. But of course, we also know that's not true, right? We imported Chinese slaves basically to build our railroads, right, and take us out west. We had the chattel slavery, the descendants of Africans, to build many of our cities. Do you know that in New York City, around before the Civil War, there were gangs of people who would walk the streets at night and kidnap black New Yorkers and take them down south, right? So it wasn't just exclusively the South, right? Mm-hmm. The United States was built on these things. So rugged individualism is an ideal, and rugged individualism is an image of the cowboy, of John Wayne, of all these other things. But, you know, John Wayne doesn't get the girl at the end. He rides off into the sunset by himself, because to be a rugged individualist means to not love, to not have a family, to not care for your kid. That's what individualism in extremis is, and that's why at the end of the cowboy movie, the boy is screaming, "Shane, Shane, come back," a very old reference, but nevertheless, "Shane, Shane, come back," because the cowboy would rather be on his own, he and his horse, in the wilderness than tied down to a family.
Another fascinating discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a philosophy professor at UND. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. This was such a complex thing. I really feel like we just touched the surface.
Yeah, barely. Still to come on Main Street, Arts and Humanities Month. But first, this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. North Dakota's COVID-19 death toll has now reached 1,597 after two more residents with the virus passed away. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, 645 individuals from 44 counties have tested positive. Today's results are from a batch of 10,552 tests for a daily positive rate of 6.45%. There are currently 3,604 active confirmed cases statewide. Of the new cases, 136 were found in Cass County, 112 in Burleigh County, and 62 in Stark County. A detailed map of all new cases from each county is posted on our news page at news.prairiepublic.org. The director of North Dakota's Airline Commission says in August, the 8 commercial service airports in the state saw a decline in boardings when compared to July. Kyle Warner says traditionally August does mark a slowdown. He says the numbers we have now aren't unexpected, and the decline does not dampen the spirits.
Well, we're kind of at a little peak at this point, so we saw quite a bit of growth, particularly this last spring and summer, due to an incredible amount of pent-up demand and leisure travel.
Warner says at 82,000 boardings in July, the numbers are still down 15 to 20% from pre-pandemic levels, but he still says it's a manageable situation.
When I say 15, 20%, too, when you look at the 2019 numbers that we're actually comparing them to in the pre-pandemic era, that was an incredibly busy year for airlines as well. And so, you know, to give some perspective, we're actually still doing pretty darn good.
Water says while recreational travel saw a return over the summer, the challenge now is to get business travel numbers restored.
But we still have the best airline service really that we've ever had historically in our state when you take a look at the destinations and the flights that are available for to our flying public. So we've actually sustained the difficulties over the last year really well.
An invasive bug recently found in Kansas could spell trouble for agricultural states if more are confirmed. Harvest Public Media's Katie Pikus has this report.
The spotted lanternfly has bright red hind wings with black spots. It may look pretty, but Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis says this pest and its, quote, piercing, sucking mouth parts feed on sap, which will weaken lots of fruit and woody trees.
Eventually, these insects could feed on the sap from dozens and dozens of different kinds of plants, causing problems for us.
The state of Kansas and federal officials are investigating after one of the bugs was found in a 4-H project. Native to Asia, the spotted lanternfly was first seen in Pennsylvania in 2014 and is a skilled hitchhiker. The Iowa and Nebraska Ag Departments have both received possible sightings of the insect, but so far they've all been false alarms. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
And from the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And if you are out looking at the trees, you are noticing that there is some leaf changing as fall is officially upon us after the autumnal equinox. And of course, fall is easy to think about this change visually, those vibrant colors. But what about what it sounds like? Biologist Chuck Lura is here with this week's Natural North Dakota.
Fall's officially here. Labor Day's in the rearview mirror. School has started. And, of course, the equinox occurred on the 22nd. With the coming of fall, many among us wait in eager anticipation for the leaves to turn color. Every year about this time, we get anxious to see the trees put on their annual color displays. The fall colors are delightful, and they seem to garner much of our attention and media coverage. But don't lose sight, pun intended, of the sounds of fall. There are many sounds to hear during the fall, ranging from the rustling of leaves to the bugling of elk. But it's perhaps the sounds of migrating waterfowl that best characterize the sounds of the season. Perhaps it's the gurgling of sandhill cranes or the hooting of tundra swans overhead that catches our attention. No doubt some of you recognize the earlier recording of snow geese. Large flocks of snow geese on their migration to warmer climes seems to always pique a sense of awe and wonder of the natural world. If it's waterfowl you're after, they can be found across the state, and most North Dakotans live within easy driving distance to a national wildlife refuge. In many of the refuges, waterfowl can be easily observed during the fall migration. Examples include J. Clark Salyer National Wildlife Refuge near Upham, Tewaka National Wildlife Refuge in Sargent County, Del Lac National Wildlife Refuge near Kenmare, and Audubon National Wildlife Refuge near Cull Harbor. Plus, there are many waterfowl production areas and wildlife management areas where waterfowl can be observed. And, of course, if you spend time outdoors most anywhere in the state, you may hear and see waterfowl overhead. So make a point of getting outdoors and enjoying some more of the natural world this fall. Soak in the sights and sounds of the season. Although you may be able to enjoy the sights from the comfort of your home or car, to really enjoy the sounds of fall, you need to spend some time outdoors. So find some places outdoors to relax, get comfortable, and listen to the sounds of fall in North Dakota. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141-member rural electric systems in 9 states. And by AARP North Dakota. Looking for ways to safely stay active, healthy, and informed without leaving home? AARP North Dakota has lots of online offerings. Learn more about the ways you can stay connected to your community at aarp.org/ndevents.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and by the end of this week, we will be into October, which can be a lovely fall season, but more importantly, it is Arts and Humanities Month. I am joined now from our Bismarck studio by Kim Conoco. She is the Executive Director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Kim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
What has you most excited about Arts and Humanities Month?
Well, it's an incredible celebration that takes place across the country of culture in America. It was launched by Americans for the Arts more than 30 years ago, and it has 4 primary goals. So the first is to create a national, state, and local focus on arts and humanities through the media, encourage active participation of individuals as well as arts, humanities, and other interested organizations nationwide, and it is also to establish a highly visible vehicle for raising public awareness about the arts and humanities. So we partner with Humanities ND, and we put forth a proclamation which goes before the governor, and we will get this proclamation next week and be able to do a photo opportunity at the Capitol with the governor.
Well, those are 3 pretty incredible words: focus, participate, and then, of course, being visible. Let's talk about the word participate here, because this is the most actionable one here. When you say participation, are you talking from the perspective of the Council on the Arts and artists and getting more artists more active, or are you talking people interacting with arts, some of each?
I think it's both. I think that in particular in North Dakota, we announce it as Arts and Humanities Month, and then we count on our grantees and humanities organizations across the state to really take up that gauntlet and put that banner out there that we want to see more participation, more people active. I think that as COVID may be wrapping up, but there certainly is a return to going to see live theater, going to shows, listening to concerts, being at events as a community. So that participation, whether it's in arts or humanities, is critical across the state.
Yeah, I went to a concert about 2 weeks ago, and I was like, oh, yeah. People.
And there is no feeling like live, whether,
yeah, right?
Again, it's a gallery opening or a show or a concert, but there's an energy that starts to move through the room, and it is exhilarating, and it is enlivening, and it shows the power of our coming together through arts and humanities events.
In as much as these things are possible to predict, are you thinking there'll be a little explosion in arts and humanities-based activities now as we're, you know, moving about a little bit more freely?
Yes, I definitely do. I think that humanities is incredibly busy right now with a number of events coming up, whether it's and most of them online, but just an availability of great lectures and great events. And in the arts across the state, we know that the fall in particular is the kind of viewed as the opening of the season.
A lovely season opening event for people who want to be connected to arts across the region, or maybe I'll just call it arts across the prairie, because this has been quite a lot of activity from the part of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Remind our listeners, what is the Arts Across the Prairie Initiative?
So this is a program of NDCA, and it began as a part of the Main Street Summit in 2019. And what we decided was that we wanted to really work on exploring the cultural heritage of North Dakotans across the state. The best way to do that was by region, and within each region, there are counties. So what we're working on is 8 large-scale public installations, and that will be based on stakeholder input from each region. And the group has to explore what are its roots, who are the people that came there, who are the people that were there before, what is going on now, and what does the future look like, and then work across county lines to decide on some thematic input for artists who will be reached through a request for proposals to build a large-scale installation.
And we last talked about this a couple of months ago. Is there an update?
There is. So Region 1, bless their hearts, as a result of COVID, has been meeting for over 18 months via Zoom. And we came together in June and went and looked at 3 sites, and we have narrowed down the installation sites to 3 locales: Burnt Hills, and then way further up north, Writing Rock and the Fortuna Radar Base. At this point now, we're exploring who owns this land, how can we use it. The Arts Council is not necessarily interested in owning land, but to build on the land and create a large scale, again, who knows what it will be, mosaic, sculpture, metal, cement. It could be panels. It could be murals. It could be anything. It could include sound. It could include movement. But our only guideline was is that it had to be in a rural location. And people always say, well, what does that mean? And I say, no buildings, no people. So we did find 3 very remote locations, and we're looking into those. We've also received legislative funding, which was remarkable. We have an appropriation for $1 million, and that will go into our endowment fund, and we will be able to spend the interest on the maintenance for the 8 pieces. We also have a new AmeriCorps service member who is Francesca Zitar, and she is here in Bismarck, and she will be the facilitator for the program statewide. So it's been really moving along. We've got 2 grants pending with federal resources, and we hope to start the build on Region 1 in July. And then simultaneously, we have Regions 4 over in the northwest corner of the state, and Region 2, North Central, who are undertaking the start of forming their stakeholder groups.
And is it the ultimate hope that someone goes on, for example, a road trip, a bike trip, you know, going from one region to the next, specifically
Absolutely.
To see just this art?
Absolutely. We have an incredible partnership with Department of Transportation, and they will be helping us with an installation if it's placed off a state road in terms of the road, the pullout, the parking, the signage. Mm-hmm. We also have a great relationship with tourism, and they will market this as a complete separate tour. And at each site, there will be rack cards and other information that's available on every other cultural attraction or arts business or arts programming group or individual artists in that region. So we really hope that people move around the state and discover who we are and where we came from. And that cultural heritage is critical.
Well, and I'm thinking to couple this with that Votes for Women campaign that's going on with highway markers across the state. And you can get some history and you can get some art. And then, you know, there's always fresh air and being outdoors.
Absolutely. And I have to pay homage to Gary Greff of the Enchanted Highway. But it's who knows what they'll look like, but they will just be there, and we will guide them to these sites. And I think it's a remarkable way for people both in North Dakota and from outside to explore who we are, where we came from. And then I think it's also really incredible for artists in North Dakota. One of the things that we're requiring is that every artist whom we hire, if they are not a North Dakota artist, is that they will train our artists in how to do these outdoor installations. Because I don't think we have a lot of people here who understand the real engineering that's involved.
It's so hard.
It's so hard. And they're so big, and you have elements that you have to deal with.
Yeah, wind, snow,
exactly.
Sun, all the weather things here,
all
tornadoes.
The weather things, yes.
We're visiting with Kim Conoco. She is the executive director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. You can always find out more at arts.nd.gov. And Kim, you've mentioned funding a little bit, but I know we're coming up on round two of the American Relief Program funding, right? Is that what did I get that right? ARP?
Yes.
Okay. So there was a round one of funding, and it's been an interesting time in certain nonprofits to have more money than they're used to being able to give out as we are recovering from the coronavirus. What's coming up for round two? And that deadline's coming up October 15th.
It is, and I know that this is a crazy thing to say, but I wish that the federal government, and I have told this to the National Endowment for the Arts, but I do wish that we could in some way slow down or regulate some of the money that's coming in.
We're scaling too quickly.
We're scaling quickly, and there's no question that there is a need to be filled. But each time we're given money, we have to design a program to get the money out. And we're doing our best not to reinvent the wheel every time, but each resource, if it's different. So, for example, last year we got money from National Endowment for the Arts, OMB through the state, and then the third was from the Bush Foundation. And each had very, very different criteria. So you still have to work with that and try to come up with a program that you can manage and that your grantees will be able to understand. I think this year what we were surprised by was we did get a large grant, almost $700,000.
Wow.
And for us, that is absolutely huge. But we had $1,774,555,000 in requests. We had 155 applicants. So we were not able to fund everything at full in order to leave money for round two coming up. So we have $342,330 to dispense from the October 15th deadline.
So I guess the first question there is, if someone didn't get funding in round one, does that mean don't try again? Or does that mean no, try again?
Well, we gave feedback, and the thing that we really had to point to was the criteria, which was an opportunity for the sector not just to reestablish old ways of operating, but to rebuild in a way that works better for all arts organizations.
Mm.
So individuals and organizations, their primary mission had to be to promote and provide connection through creative expression by sharing creative experiences, expressing their own creativity, or connecting people with their local and statewide communities through the arts. So we told everyone who didn't get funded that they could, but they had to really think about the criteria and be sure that they were focused on it. And with new applications, because we've been receiving so many questions, we do know that we'll be getting a lot of applications again, and we'll do our best to thoroughly read them and think about what is meeting the criteria that's been set forth.
And you can find out more about those grant possibilities at arts.nd.gov. Kim, the North Dakota Council on the Arts is working on diversity, equity, and inclusion. What are you doing?
So the first thing I'd say is nobody really knows what those words mean.
Right.
And in saying that, I think that they have come to mean many different things to different people in different parts of the country. As the world has changed, and it has, we've seen moving toward our location in the northern part of the United States a lot that's coming from the East Coast, the West Coast, the South. And we are unto ourselves a fairly homogeneous state. And for North Dakota Council on the Arts to examine this, we took the words diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we're really trying to focus on access and also on inclusivity. So for us, that means really looking at who we're serving and how we're serving them. So it's really an internal look for the organization in terms of, are our guidelines accessible? Are they inclusive? Are they welcoming? Are we offering programs that people in North Dakota really need? We've engaged a consulting group called Compass out of Denver. This was after about 5 months of looking for a consultant who I felt would really, really deal well with North Dakotans. We are open, but we are closed in many ways. I think we're really looking at what people consider different, how we bring our own internal biases to just even conversations and meeting people. And this came out of a request from many of our institutional support grantees during COVID, because as they've heard about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, they were like, well, what is it and how do I talk about it and how do I talk to my audiences and what do I say to my board members and my staff?
Right.
So we're really looking at just having some initial conversations. We're doing this with a cohort of people from across the state that are very diverse who can really be honest and open. There are people who have been involved in some DEI work in their own organizations or in their work as individual artists already. And ideally, what we hope is that it's at the end of our training, which should be in December and will also include work for our board, that we have an idea of how to go forward for NDCA. What do we think about in our website, our guidelines, our applications, our programs? I think we are ready to walk the talk.
Kim Conoco is the executive director for the North Dakota Council on the Arts. You can find out more at arts.nd.gov. And October is Arts and Humanities Month. Thanks so much for your time today, Kim.
Really appreciate being here. Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, lifelong learner. Humanities North Dakota is featuring scholar Angus Fletcher, author of Wonderworks, the 25 most powerful inventions in the history of literature. He will show how writers throughout the ages have created technical breakthroughs and engineering enhancements to the human heart and mind. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 27th. On this date, in 1951, a city law was proposed in Minot that created a stir. It would restrict city employees from having a second job. Originally, the proposal targeted police officers. At a meeting held to discuss this and other ordinances, it was pointed out that the city already had such a law for firemen, so it seemed logical to adopt the same for policemen. However, a number of the committee members found this unfair, including the mayor, who claimed the ordinance was aimed at a specific police officer. The officer was Gil Johnson. Johnson was born in Iceland in 1901 and had come to Bantry, North Dakota as a child. He served in the Army during World War I and then worked as a bricklayer for a number of years, eventually settling in Minot. In 1934, he became a police officer, and in 1950, even ran for sheriff of Ward County. All the while, he kept a side job as a bricklayer. His second job hadn't been a problem, but on July 31, 1951, the chief of police was charged with violating the civil service law of the city when 12 police officers said he rigged the police department's civil service examination so his favorites would get promoted, and those who weren't his favorites couldn't take the exam. Johnson was named as one of the injured parties. With the case going to court, many of the men were put on leave, and some even dismissed. Firemen, radio operators, and others filled in. Johnson was visiting in Iceland during this time. In the wake of the dispute, the ordinance to disallow a second job was perceived by some as a way to target Johnson. It was decided that, if anything, the proposal should apply to all city employees, not just policemen. And as such, instead of an ordinance, perhaps they should amend the civil service law. The mayor weighed in, saying, "Listen, our policemen and firemen have had to become professional blood donors, as it is now, in order to get along and keep their families together. They are selling their blood for $25 a pint. What do you want them to do? If you restrict them from picking up extra money at legitimate jobs, they'll have to sell not only their blood, but their flesh." In the end, Officer Gil Johnson remained on duty. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
They voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but not in 2020.
I was happy for 2 years. I was miserable for the next two. And so that's why I voted the way I voted.
But that doesn't mean these swing voters are satisfied.
It's like a roller coaster. It's not just a down or an up. You never know from day to day, I don't think economically, what's going on.
How can Democrats hold on to their votes? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Walking the Good Red Road, Nicholas Black Elk's Journey to Sainthood. We visit with Sister Judith Zielinski. She is the producer of that documentary that explores the life of a man who was both a catechist within the Catholic Church and a Lakota healer. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.